Welcome back, children of the revolution, to What You're Not Listening To, the audio educational and anthologies program here on Ace of Spades, PDX.com. And I'm your host, show producer, webmaster, audio engineer, researcher, video promo producer, and writer, Daddy Ben Bear, Ben Brown Jr., doing it all here on the DIYs, sponsoring commercial free. And today we're looking at more than Apple vanity. And this is our 100th program. Thank you all for being here and sticking around and listening to the shows. If you're new, listen to the older ones. The fact that you've just stuck around this long is mind-blowing in and of itself. And for this series' 100th program, an extended show dedicated to some of the many talented artists on music history's most amazing experiment in the business, Apple Records, that started off with great promise but crashed and burned amid a bitter divorce among what were once close friends. By 1967, the Beatles had seemingly done the impossible. The Fab Four, as the press dubbed them, John Lennon, Paul McCartney, George Harrison, and Ringo Starr, hailed from a town no one had heard of or cared about called Liverpool, and after initially honing their craft in basement bars at home and strip joints overseas, they were playing stadiums and had conquered the entertainment world with a series of popular films, highly rated television performances, and record sales that dwarfed everyone else before them. Their album that year, Sgt. Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band, would become the most studied and dissected piece of music in the 20th century. They were rich, young, and seemingly a font of artistic brilliance with no shortage of ideas. But what do you do with all that money and fame when the tax man comes a-knockin'? Brian Epstein, their manager, formed a corporation as a tax haven for the band, originally called Beatles Inc. in 1967, that would morph into what is still known today as Apple Corps. Yes, the pun was intentional. It was going to be diversified: electronics, films, a clothing boutique, and most notably, a record label. Epstein died during the Summer of Love in August of 67. A disastrous film in December that year, Magical Mystery Tour, illustrated just how lost the band were without him, and they needed a win. By the time of the launch of the label, almost a year to the day of Epstein's passing, it would turn out, in hindsight, that their former manager was the glue that somehow kept the four friends together and on task. What wasn't known to much of the outside world was just how badly and quickly the cracks between the members had become. The former Fab Four put on a good face for the press, but it was becoming obvious that things were not well in Pepperland. They would and did find, at least initially, a rare joy amidst all the tumult by closely working with artists on their new label, since they had also stopped touring and, for the most part, working together. They would often act as producers, players, and songwriters for many on their roster, some who were new and some who were veteran acts. Though not the first vanity label, Reprise by Frank Sinatra, Tangerine by Ray Charles, Brother by the Beach Boys, and Bizarre by Frank Zappa preceded them, where artists are often signed to their own imprint and fostered other talent they like, Apple was above and beyond the most recognizable and easily the one with the biggest ever roster that is self-owned by the lead artist, in spite of their brief recorded output. They would also blow it quite often. The label didn't have traditional talent scouts. In the early days, it was the members of the Beatles themselves who performed the bulk of this task, and at least one member of the band had to approve of any new signing. This led them to miss out on iconic acts such as Yes and David Bowie. A little more than 3 years after forming Apple, all but the film company and the record label had fallen into disarray or had closed altogether. Of course, the band went through a very ugly, public, and messy business divorce as well during this period. This also caused a great deal of friction at the label. The band members were ready to leave it behind, but it would take until the mid-1970s to sort it all out. Making matters worse, they were also unbelievably and completely broke by the beginning of the 70s and had themselves ended up with an unscrupulous manager in Alan Klein, a man who eventually did time for lying to the Internal Revenue Service. Not only were the Beatles unlucky in their post-Epstein business arrangement, they were also seemingly oblivious to how the music business, or any business venture for that matter, actually worked. They were adamant that their label would feature acts that were often at the cutting edge that other labels would not touch, an artist's label, so to speak. But oftentimes, when they were in the midst of such talent, they honestly didn't know how to properly promote them to radio or market them to the public. Yoko Ono and Jackie Lomax are prime examples, or assist them in sustaining careers, James Taylor and Billy Preston, among others. Klein shuttered an avant-garde subsidiary label, Zappel, after just two releases, which left several completed or planned albums, including Historical Performance by Lenny Bruce, out to sea. Also closed was the electronics division, which had an incredibly expensive but poorly designed recording studio, as well as the boutique, which one day literally opened the doors and gave away all the clothing to anyone walking past it. It also seems that many of the employees at the Apple offices were expensing large amounts of drugs, alcohol, and food at the most expensive restaurants in London with no accountability or work to show for it. The title of a 73 book by Apple insider Richard DeLeo says it all. The Longest Cocktail Party, an insider's diary of the Beatles, their multi-million dollar Apple empire, and its wild rise and fall. By 1973, Apple Records had ceased all operations with artists other than the Beatles individually or collectively, with the final release being Ass by Badfinger, the label's biggest non-Fab Four act. Interestingly, George Harrison, Ringo Starr, and Badfinger were actually outselling Paul McCartney and John Lennon for a while in the early 70s, the first three acts that were initially in the shadow of the latter two. The last Apple films at the time, Son of Dracula featuring Ringo Starr, no, for real, and then popular singer Harry Nilsson, and festival favorite Little Malcolm, starring future Alien actor John Hurt, both came and went in 1974 with little public notice. The great experiment had failed miserably, and with it, the promise of what the 1960s held also went with it for Apple. It would not become an artist label to anyone but the Beatles again until the release of the Best of Badfinger CD in 1995. Not all of the material originally released on Apple has been reissued in digital formats, with just a few holdouts, but much of it finally saw the light of day in 2011, which coincided with the documentary Strange Fruit, The Beatles' Apple Records. Of course, the label once again didn't know how to market most of it, and many of the physical titles became quickly out of print again for a second time. Some of it was never to sport an Apple logo again, but was released by other labels. Some people never learn. Some people are just not business savvy, and some are just in it for the music and the adventure. Hopefully, the latter two being why all of you are here. Just remember, you may not be ready for this, but here we go. And just letting everyone know now that this program will contain language and subject matter that some do not find suitable. And we're going to be kicking off our 100th program here with an act that was originally called the Ivies and hailed from Swansea, Wales. In addition to several worldwide hits they recorded and released, the band's songwriting principals, Pete Ham and Tom Evans, wrote Without You, which Harry Nilsson took to number one in the US and the UK, a feat that Mariah Carey almost duplicated two decades later. From 1970, from the album No Dice, this is No Matter What by Badfinger, and we'll see you in just a little over 35 minutes. I will always be around.
Everybody called him the fucking. And the fucking thought what he wanted to think. I said the fucking, he said what he wanted to say. Oh, oh, mighty, mighty fucking. All hail the fucking. The mighty fucking. All hail, all hail, all hail. The mighty fucking. Thank you.
no one like her, but no one at all. And as for charm, hers is like wall to wall. She married Ringo, and she could have had Paul. That's why the lady is a champ. Creates excitement whenever it's dull. She just appears, and there goes the lull. She merely smiles, and you're out of your skull. That's why the lady is a champ. The folks who do and don't meditate agree she's great. They mean Maureen. I've got more lyrics right after this vamp. Because the lady is a champ. Though we've not met, I'm convinced she's a gem. I'm just SS, but to me, she's Big M. Mainly because she prefers me to them. That's why the lady is a champ. I have lots of fans, well, at least one or two. But Peter Brown called me to tell me it's true. She sleeps with Ringo, but she thinks of you. That's why the lady is a champ. But I can boast as much as I please. The fact is that she's his wife, but that's life. But it's her day, so I whistle and stamp. Because the lady, the charming lady, Mr. Ringo's lady, is a champ. May I toast you all the way? Lift my glass and softly say, I have thoughts for you this day, but beautiful thoughts for you and for your Ringo that I must express with a warm and deep affection of FS. Would you kindly ask the guys if they'd grab a glass and rise? 'Cause I think we'd harmonize. But beautiful, may your birthdays and your birthday candles softly gleam and glow. For that would be but beautiful, I know.
Welcome back, children of the revolution, to What You're Not Listening To, here on Ace of Spades, PDX.com, the audio educational and anthology series, here on our 100th show. And if I didn't mention it earlier, because I do not believe I did, happy January 2021. I know we've made it, a whole bunch of us did not, and let's just be grateful that we are still here to tell the tale and remember those that we lost. And hopefully we're looking forward to a beautiful and better 2021. Now let's get back to what we're all here for. And that's the Apple Records show here we're doing. And it's going to be an extended one. It's going to be actually our longest show probably ever. I don't know if I could ever do this again, but here we are. And we kicked off our program with No Matter What from 1970 by Badfinger from the album No Dice. Following that, from 1968, from the album Is This What You Want by Jackie Lomax, and the song was Sour Milk Sea. Lomax was a friend of the Beatles from their early days in Liverpool, and just like the Fab Four, one of his early bands, The Undertakers, also went to Hamburg, Germany to hone their live skills. This was one of the first four commercially available singles released by Apple in 1968 and is less R&B based than the majority of Lomax's output. Following that, from 1970, from the Plastic Ono Band version by Yoko Ono, Why, the lead track on that. Before she was known as Mrs. John Lennon, Yoko Ono, the daughter of a successful Japanese businessman, went to college in New York where her parents had relocated. Her bohemian lifestyle upset her parents, and she spent a great deal of time before becoming a recording artist as one of the leading lights in the Fluxus movement. Following that, Visitor from Mars from the album Space from 1969 by the Modern Jazz Quartet. A truly unique jazz group that hit its stride initially in the 60s while on Atlantic. The group, led by Milt Jackson for many years on the vibraphone, a xylophone-like instrument, espoused a degree of sophistication that was derived from Baroque music. They would record two albums for Apple, the label's only jazz signing. After that, from the album Encouraging Words by Billy Preston from 1970, Right Now. Preston, a child prodigy that got his start playing for gospel legend Mahalia Jackson, also spent time in a variety of other R&B groups. It was while on tour in Little Richard's band, with the Beatles as the support act, that led the group to ask him to work with them. In addition to his playing on the Get Back single and album, he also toured with George Harrison for several years, the Rolling Stones as well. Following that, The King of Pho from 1969 by Brute Force, and that was a single A-side. And Brute Force is actually the stage name of Stephen Friedland, a songwriter and performer from New York. He had worked with a variety of pop acts in the early 1960s, including The Tokens and Peggy March. This is his most notorious release, one that Apple's parent labels, EMI and Capitol, refused to handle, so 1,000 copies were put together by hand by the staff and the band themselves. After that, Saturday Night Special from 1972 by the Sundown Playboys, and that was a single A-side. Of all of the singles released by Apple, this may be the one that no one truly saw coming, especially the artists. The band was originally founded in 1945 in Lake Charles, a small town in southwestern Louisiana, near the Texas border. The group's youngest member, 16-year-old accordion player Pat Savant, sent a locally produced copy of the record to Apple. George Harrison loved it and released it as Apple's single 44 with a sleeve that featured a photo of the band on the front and the lyrics to both sides of the single on the back in French Cajun. Following that, Ain't That Cute from 1970 by Doris Troy from her self-titled album on Apple. And she was originally also signed to Atlantic, and the Beatles signed Doris because of the strength of her biggest hit, Just One Look, a stone-cold soul classic that she wrote, which was recorded in 10 minutes and released in its demo form. She also wrote this track with George Harrison, and in spite of excellent reviews, it sold poorly. And the track we just heard from 1968, Frank Sinatra, yes, Frank Sinatra, The Lady is a Champ, and that was a bootleg of Apple's single number one. The first release by Apple was never made available to the public. It was a gift from Ringo Starr to his wife Maureen on her 22nd birthday, and only one known copy is known to exist, making it one of the rarest recordings by a major recording artist in history. At the time, Sinatra was just coming off his first and only two number one singles on Reprise. Oh my God. And we're going to be kicking off our next show by talking about Phil Spector, which was our next act's husband at the time and the architect of the wall of sound production technique of the early 60s, and had come out of retirement to work with the Beatles collectively and individually. A condition of this work was to have his wife record for the label, who happened to be the lead singer in one of the greatest girl groups of all time, the Ronettes. This song, written by George Harrison, sold poorly, and the planned full-length LP never materialized due to Phil's increasingly erratic behavior. This is the single A-side to Try Some, Buy Some from 1970 by the one and only Ronnie Spector, and we'll see you just before the grand finale.
Way back in time, someone said try some. I tried some, now buy some. I bought some. Whoa, whoa, whoa. After a while, when I had tried them, denied them, I opened my eyes and I saw you. Ooh.
This is a chapter from my novel, Trout Fishing in America. The chapter is called The Hunchback Trout. The creek was made narrow by little green trees that grew too close together. The creek was like 12,845 telephone booths in a row with high Victorian ceilings and all the doors taken off and all the backs of the booths knocked out. Sometimes when I went fishing in there, I felt just like a telephone repairman, even though I did not look like one. I was only a kid covered with fishing tackle. But in some strange way, by going in there and catching a few trout, I kept the telephones in service. I was an asset to society. It was pleasant work, but at times it made me uneasy. It could grow dark in there instantly when there were some clouds in the sky and they worked their way onto the sun. Then you almost needed candles to fish by and foxfire in your reflexes. Once I was in there when it started raining. It was dark and hot and steamy. I was, of course, on overtime. I had that going in my favor. I caught 7 trout in 15 minutes. The trout in those telephone booths were good fellows. There were a lot of young cutthroat trout 6 to 9 inches long, perfect pen size for local calls. Sometimes there were a few fellows, 11 inches or so, for the long-distance calls. I've always liked cutthroat trout. They put up a good fight, running against the bottom and then broad jumping. Under their throats, they fly the orange banner of Jack the Ripper. Also in the creek were a few stubborn rainbow trout, seldom heard from, but they're all the same, like certified public accountants. I'd catch one every once in a while. They were fat and chunky, almost as wide as they were long. I've heard those trout called squire trout. It used to take me about an hour to hitchhike to that creek. There was a river nearby. The river wasn't much. The creek was where I punched in. Leaving my cart above the clock, I'd punch out again when it was time to go home. I remember the afternoon I caught the hunchback trout. A farmer gave me a ride in a truck. He picked me up at a traffic signal beside a bean field, and he never said a word to me. His stopping and picking me up and driving me down the road was as automatic a thing to him as closing the barn door. Nothing need be said about it, but still I was in motion, traveling 35 miles an hour down the road, watching houses and groves of trees go by, watching chickens and mailboxes enter and pass through my vision. Then I did not see any houses for a while. "This is where I get out," I said. The farmer nodded. The truck stopped. "Thanks a lot," I said. The farmer did not ruin his audition for the Metropolitan Opera by making a sound. He just nodded his head again. The truck started up. He was the original silent old farmer. A little while later, I was punching in at the creek. I put my card above the clock and went into that long tunnel of telephone booths. I waited about 73 telephone booths in. I caught 2 trout in a little hole. It was like a wagon wheel. It was one of my favorite holes and always good for a trout or two. I always like to think of that hole as a kind of pencil sharpener. I put my reflexes in and they came back out with a good point on them. Over a period of a couple of years, I must have caught 50 trout in that hole, though it was only as big as a wagon wheel. I was fishing with salmon eggs and using a size 14 single egg hook on a 1.25 pound test tippet. The 2 trout lay in my creel covered entirely by green ferns, ferns made gentle and fragile by the damp walls of telephone booths. The next good place was 45 telephone booths in. The place was at the end of a run of gravel, brown and slippery with algae. The run of gravel dropped off and disappeared at a little shelf where there were some white rocks. One of the rocks was kind of strange. It was a flat white rock. Off by itself from the other rocks, it reminded me of a cat I had seen in my childhood. The cat had fallen or been thrown off a high wooden sidewalk that went along the side of a hill in Tacoma, Washington. The cat was lying in a parking lot below. The fall had not appreciably helped the thickness of the cat, and then a few people had parked their cars on the cat. Of course, that was a long time ago, and the cars looked different from the way they look now. You hardly see those cars anymore. They are the old cars. They have to get off the highway because they can't keep up. That flat white rock off by itself from the other rocks reminded me of that dead cat come to lie there in the creek among 12,845 telephone booths. I threw out a salmon egg and let it drift down over that rock, and wham, a good hit, and I had the fish on, and it ran hard downstream, cutting at an angle and staying deep and really coming on hard, solid and uncompromising, and then the fish jumped, and for a second I thought it was a frog. I had never seen a fish like that before. God damn, what the hell? The fish ran deep again, and I could feel its life energy screaming back up the line to my hand. The line felt like sound. It was like an ambulance siren coming straight at me, red light flashing, and then going away again, and then taking to the air and becoming an air raid siren. The fish jumped a few more times, and it still looked like a frog, but it didn't have any legs. Then the fish grew tired and sloppy, and I swung and splashed it up the surface of the creek and into my net. The fish was a 12-inch rainbow trout with a huge hump on its back. A hunchback trout, the first I'd ever seen. The hump was probably due to an injury that occurred when the trout was young. Maybe a horse stepped on it, or a tree fell over in a storm, or its mother spawned where they were building a bridge. There was a fine thing about that trout. I only wish I could have made a death mask of him. Not of his body, though, but of his energy. I don't know if anyone would have understood his body. I put it in my creel. Later in the afternoon, when the telephone booths began to grow dark at the edges, I punched out of the creek and went home. I had that hunchback trout for dinner, wrapped in cornmeal and fried in butter. Its hump tasted sweet as the kisses of Esmeralda.
See me run, 'cause I ain't got Just a knocking around the zoo on a Thursday afternoon. There's bars on all the windows and they're counting up a spoon, babe. And if I'm feeling edgy, it's a chick who's paid to be my slave. Yeah, oh, watch out, James. But she'll hit me with a needle. She thinks I'm trying to misbehave, yeah. Now the keeper's trying to cool me, says I'm bound to be alright. But I know that he can't fool me, cause I'm putting him up tight, yeah. And I can feel him getting edgy every time I make a sudden move, whoa, whoa, yes it's true. And I can hear him celebrating every time I up and leave the room. See me, they point at me and stare. Said he's just like the rest of us, so what's he doing there? Now they hide in their movie theater, drinking juice, keeping tight. What's that bright light, Bishop? Cause I'm certain about one thing, babe, that zoo's no place to spend the night, no, no. Up spoons, babe. And if I'm feeling edgy, there's a chick who's paid to be my slave. Yeah, watch out, cooch. But you hit me with a needle if you think so, try to misbehave. Yeah.
The whale, marine mammal of the order Cetacea. They comprise three groups. One, Archaeocetae, believed to have been derived from the Credonta, the primitive fossil members of the carnivora. Their teeth consist of three incisors, one canine, four premolars, and 3 to 2 molars on either side of each jaw. A milk dentition is found. Two, Mystacocetae, or whalebone whales, in which the mouth contains fine plate-like structures supported by the palate in place of teeth, and three, Odontocetae, or toothed whales, believed to have descended from the Archaeocetae, which includes sperm whales, dolphins, and porpoises. The most prized species is the blue whale, the largest of all animals, which is found chiefly in the Antarctic Ocean. It reaches a length of 100 feet and a weight of at least 120 tons. Whales are migrant animals, the movements of which are conditioned by surface temperatures and by their search for food. Blue, fin, and humpback whales enter the Antarctic in summer and feed on vast shoals of southern krill, an oceanic shrimp some 2.5 inches long, which feeds on single-celled plants called phytoplankton. In winter, they frequent the warmer latitudes to breed. The sperm whale is the largest toothed whale. It attains a length of 60 feet, but the male is much larger than the female and is polygamous. Fin and humpback whales may reach lengths of 65 and 50 feet respectively. Whales are warm-blooded, breathe air, and have lungs. The skin is naked, but they conserve their body heat by immense layers of blubber, from which enormous quantities of whale oil are produced. The bulk of this oil is processed into margarine, but there are many useful byproducts, for example, frozen whale meat, meat meal, meat extracts, bone meal, liver oil, and vitamin extracts. Whales bear their young like land mammals. The breeding of whalebone whales takes place in low latitudes in winter, and pregnancy lasts for about a year. Only one calf is born, and this is nursed for about 7 months, after which the parent rests until the next breeding season. statistics on the whaling industry are compiled annually by the Norwegian Committee for Whaling Statistics. After World War II, the International Whaling Commission was formed, and most governments whose nationals engage in whaling are members of it. The major field for whaling is the Antarctic, and here only a certain number of whales is permitted to be caught in any season. There are, however, also comprehensive regulations for whaling in all parts of the world. A recent development in the industry is whale marking. This was begun in 1926 by the Discovery Committee, and prior to World War II, some 5,000 whales had been marked in the Antarctic, chiefly by the William Scoresby, a vessel especially designed for the purpose. In 1953, a whale marking expedition was jointly financed by the whaling company of the British Commonwealth. We'll be right back.
Fuck is not a dirty word, man. That's right, fuck is not a dirty word. Perhaps one of the most interesting words in the English language today is the word fuck. It is this one magical word that just by its very sound can describe pain, pleasure, hate, and love. Fuck, as most words in the English language, takes its stem from the German Fricken, which means to strike. In language today, fuck falls into many grammatical categories and has many usages. It can be used as a verb or transitive. John fucked Mary. And in transitive, Mary was fucked by John. It can be used as an adjective. Mary is fucking beautiful. As an adverb. Mary is fucking interested in John. And as a noun, Mary is a fine fuck. See, there are not many words with the versatility of fuck.
It feels good.
Besides the sexual meaning, there are also the following usages. Fraud. I got fucked at the used car lot. Aggression. Fuck you! Disbelief. What the fuck is going on here? Difficulty. I can't understand this fucking job. Dismay. Oh, fuck it. Incompetence. He's a fuck off. Inferiority. Boy, what a fucking lousy movie. Trouble. I guess I'm really fucked now. And I know you can think of many more. With all these usages, how can anyone be offended or shocked when you say fuck? So use this unique word more often in your daily speech, if you don't use it enough yet, and say it loud and proud. Fuck you!
Welcome back, one and all, to our 100th show here, looking at the Apple Records label. From 1968 through 1973, here on aceofspadespdx.com's What You're Not Listening To, the Audio Educational Anthology Series. And let me not waste any more time, because we still have a lot to cover here before we get into our grand finale. I'm still Daddy Ben Bear, Ben Brown Jr., your host. And we kicked it all off, our second part, with Try Some Bicep from 1970 by Ronnie Spector. That was a single A-side there. After that, not from 1969, Richard Brautigan, from the album Listening to Richard Brautigan, Trout Fishing in America, The Hunchback Trout. And this was originally going to be Zapple 3, of that LP, and it was withdrawn by Alan Klein and finally released as Harvest ST-424 for our collectors in 1970 in the U.S. only. This is a final rip of that. It has been released digitally as well. This was planned to be the third release on the experimental Apple subsidiary Zapple. When Klein took control of the Beatles' financial affairs, he quickly moved to cut costs, which meant shelving this release, as well as another one at the aforementioned Lenny Bruce album. Brautigan was considered one of the greatest writers of postmodernism, and the album this is on actually is selections from several of his books. Following that, another vinyl rip, the title track to an album by Elephant's Memory from 1972, The Liberation Special. Prior to working with John and Yoko live and on several of their releases, Elephant's Memory were a New York City heavy rock band that gigged in and around Greenwich Village and known for their leftist politics. They recorded two songs for the Midnight Cowboy soundtrack, a gold seller, and had a top 50 hit with the single Mongoose. The album this is taken from is one of the few Apple releases never to be released in digital format of any kind. After that, from the debut album, self-titled debut album by James Taylor from 1968, Knockin' Around the Zoo was released in the U.S. in 1969. Considered to be one of the most disturbing songs ever written by Taylor, it stands in stark contrast to the mellow folk rock that made him famous. It is a very personal story of Taylor's time in a mental institution, one he visited to help rid him of his heroin addiction. This was the only EP he recorded for Apple before moving to Warner Brothers. After that, the title track to The Whale, Part 1 from 1970 by John Taverner. And Taverner had been composing part of what would become his first album for 3 years before it was debuted publicly and 4 years before it was released on an album. He is considered one of the leading figures in all of British classical music, and his avant-garde style set him apart from his contemporaries. His piece, Song for Athene, was played at Princess Diana's funeral. Following that, from the Radhakrishna Temple album, by the Radhakrishna Temple from 1971, Govinda. A true rarity for any Western record label, the parent album this is taken from is a collection of ancient Vedic religious songs recorded in the Hindi language. Produced by George Harrison and featuring some backing help from other Apple artists such as Billy Preston and Mary Hopkin, the single hit number 23 on the UK chart. It is derived from what is considered the world's oldest poem. And following that, We're On Our Way from 1972 by Chris Hodge and a single A-side there. And he was hoping to capitalize on the then current glam rock craze that had overtook British youth culture at the time in the UK. British singer Hodge, who recorded for recorded singles for a variety of labels in the 1970s, gave us this song about sexy ladies and UFOs in a T-Rex-sounding single. It failed to chart in the UK, but made the top 50 in the United States. Following that, Thingamabob, 1968, by the Black Dyke Mills Band, and that was a single A-side there. And the Black Dyke Mills Band is one of the oldest brass bands in England. In fact, it is the oldest brass band in England, I should say, and one of the oldest in the world. And they have a long and illustrious history, winning a truckload of awards and annual competitions for decades. In addition to this track, another one of the first Apple singles released, they also played on an Academy Award-nominated song from Babe, Pig in the City. And the song we just heard, are you ready for this? F is Not a Dirty Word. 1972, David Peel in the Lower East Side, The Pope Smokes Dope. I can't even make this up. Easily one of the most controversial albums and artists of all time, Apple's parent companies did no promotion for this release, radio wouldn't touch it, and record stores refused to carry it. Peel was a street musician and anarchist in New York who had already released two albums on Elektra and was somewhat of an underground icon. John Lennon and Yoko Ono, after seeing Peel perform from their limousine, recorded him live in the studio. Yes, John and Yoko were definitely Learjet liberals or champagne socialists, using terms of the era. Common epithets today would be Neiman Marxist or Kashmir Communist. Other Beatles refused to even be associated with the album, and it quickly fell out of print. It was finally released digitally on European label Rebeat in 2015. Critics of the release fall into two camps. Fame writer Robert Christgau of The Village Voice called it proof there is no God. David Hobson of seminal music collector collector's magazine Goldmine called it the first truly essential American album of the 1970s, as well as one of the last. And that happened. And here we are, our very last track on a very long show and all over the map. Yes, there are so many tags on this for all the different varieties of genres we've represented. I had to just use the category kitchen sink. And our last artist in this survey hails from Wales, just like our first one. She had been recording and performing songs in Welsh before being discovered by famed model Twiggy, who suggested her to Paul McCartney. He produced this track for her, an updated version with English lyrics of a Russian chanson. It was also one of the first four commercial singles on Apple. And if you have questions, feedback, comments, love letters, dedications, and requests are always welcome. Please drop me a line at DaddyBenBear, one word, DaddyBenBear @gmail.com. Thank you all for 100 amazing shows, and we hope to keep the everything up for all you. And I just hope that this is never boring. Love to you all. Truly, truly, truly love to you all. And happy 2021 again. From 1968, this was a UK single, A-side, and appeared on the US version of the LP Postcard. Mary Hopkin, which pretty much sums up what Apple was all about. Those were the days.
Busy.